This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with a packed show. Are you counting on off-grid humans to survive if we don't? We'll track the last wild humans in a report from South America. You'll hear an update on the reported collapse of the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, the further adventures of serial climate hacker Russ George, and a debate on trying to remake nature in your city. Off we go. What if a solar flare knocks out power to the world, or the latest disease escapes becoming a great plague? At least we have the consolation there are still so-called wild humans out there on the fringes to survive. Or is that just another strangely comforting myth? We are joined by a man who knows, longtime international journalist and reporter for National Geographic magazine, Scott Wallace. His latest book is The Unconquered: In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. Scott, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have a lot to talk about. There's Ecuador's promise to leave Amazon oil in the ground to save the rainforest and global warming. There's the whole issue of biodiversity and whether the great Amazon rainforest can survive, not to mention the last of its people. But first, I want to ask you, Scott, why we hear so little in mainstream media about South America. Here in the north, it's almost like the lost continent. Why do you think that is?
That's a really good question. I think in part it's because our origins, at least most of us, came from across the ocean, our forebears from the other hemisphere, from the other side of the world. So I think maybe that's part of it. We've always been had our eyes more trained on where we've come from. And generally speaking, I think there's also been a kind of cultural arrogance, if you will, that Spanish and largely Spanish-speaking countries south of us, but there's also Brazil, which we're going to talk about today, Portuguese-speaking, but I think there's a bit of cultural arrogance that for some reason we believe that the events going on there don't merit the same kind of attention.
Well, we'll try and poke a hole in that right now. You've written the book, The Unconquered, and it was a difficult journey indeed. Tell us a little bit about your search for that Amazonian tribe, the Arrow people.
Well, I joined a Brazilian government expedition. There's an elite unit inside Brazil's Indian Affairs Agency known as the Department of Isolated Indians. And their mission is to identify, locate, and protect the last uncontacted tribes within the Brazilian Amazon. The leader of the founder of that entity, the Department of Isolated Indians, and was the leader at the time I went on the expedition, was also the leader of the expedition. And our purpose, our goal was to identify, to track the extent of the wanderings of this mysterious tribe known only as the Flecheiros, or the Arrow people, without actually making contact with them. So this involved an enormous logistical effort to put a 34-member expedition in the field, first by riverboats and then smaller shallow draft punts, going deep into the jungle by river as far as we could go by river, tributaries of tributaries of tributaries of the Amazon, and then a long overland trek between the rivers coming out on in an adjacent watershed and making canoes there to return to civilization, but in the process actually crossing through the heartland of this mysterious group known as the Flecheiros, the Arrow people.
And part of the challenge was to find them but not to contact them. Why is that?
Well, the whole purpose of the Department of Isolated Indians is to actually protect the last uncontacted tribes and protect them from contact with the outside world. The tribes have no defense, immunological defense to the diseases that we carry. They remain as vulnerable to the diseases, Western-born diseases, as the first indigenous people encountered by Columbus or De Soto or Jacques Cartier 500, 450 years ago in their first encounters with indigenous people in the Americas. So the first point was to avoid contact, if at all possible, because of that dangerous transmission of disease that can take place in face-to-face contact, and also because the mission is to protect the lands of these people, and doing so to keep others from coming in. So you identify where a particular isolated tribe is, the extent of the land that it uses, and then try to get legal protection and physical protection to keep intruders from coming in.
And what happened to those tribes who were recently contacted? And you had some with you on your trip.
Yeah, we did, actually. So our expedition included 20 indigenous people from three different tribes, one of which, the Métis, had only been contacted within the last 25 years, and half of the men from their tribe who were with us, there were 12 of them, half of them, about roughly half, were old enough to remember what life was like pre-contact and what happened as a result of contact. And their tribe, for example, experienced greater than half, probably two-thirds mortality, a die-off within a couple of years of contact. And they lost not only, you know, a huge number of their people, but most of their elders, you know, the people who had the tribal knowledge and the storehouse of their tribe's history and knowledge. So this is typically what happens after contact. You have extremely high mortality rates, in many cases up to 90%, in some cases completely, you know, complete devastation. And then often following that demographic shock, the tribe loses its will to resist or to replicate itself, and the lands that once were theirs are easily overrun by invaders, whether they're loggers or ranchers or gold prospectors, what have you.
Well, Scott Wallace, let's try to break things up a little according to the resources the world wants from the Amazon region. Why don't we start with everybody's bad habit, the oil industry? How much oil is in the Amazon and who's going after it?
Well, you know, we don't really know how much is there because they're making new finds all the time, but there is a lot. As we speak, oil exploration activities are underway in Venezuela and Colombia and Ecuador and Peru and Brazil and Bolivia. There are rich hydrocarbon deposits in all of these countries. A lot of it happens to be in the western Amazon, roughly in the same place where the headwaters of the Amazonian rivers are, kind of following in an arc, the Brazilian border kind of echoing that arc and ramifying out toward the west on both sides of the Brazilian border in, you know, the border countries, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and on the Brazilian side as well. A lot of the oil is located there under the ground. It happens to be the same area that is the highest, richest biodiversity of any place on the planet, this area where the Andes meets the Amazon, and is also the place where the great preponderance of uncontacted indigenous communities continue to hold forth.
President Rafael Correa of Ecuador startled the world and set an admirable precedent by saying, due to the threat of global warming, he would leave some of that country's Amazon oil in the ground. What deal did he propose?
That's the Yasuni ITT initiative. ITT stands for one of the oil blocks in eastern Ecuador that has is known to have some 850 million barrels of crude in the ground. Correa made this proposal to the international community a number of years ago now that Ecuador would be willing to leave the oil that's underneath the ITT block in the ground if the international community would help Ecuador to the tune of $3.6 billion in development money that would be roughly half of the revenue that Ecuador would have gotten in 2007 dollars for tapping that oil.
Well, I'd love to see that kind of a deal made in the Arctic as well, if we could save what's left of the climate. But how has the international community responded to this proposal by Ecuador?
So far, I'd have to say the response has been tepid. There have been pledges and debt relief that total somewhere around, I think, $300 million, which is not nothing to sneeze at, but is a long way from the goal of $3.6 billion. So international community support has been muted. You know, the proposal came, there was a kind of a confluence of very unfortunate events, the failure, the breakdown of global climate talks being one of them, the global economic downturn another, And then, you know, because of President Correa's, the perception among certain countries, including the United States and many Western countries, that the government of President Correa is less than reliable. A lot of the Western countries have very skeptical views of President Correa and his clear alignment with the previous president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and other sort of left-leaning governments.
So they don't like his politics, and we'll let the climate develop as it will. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Scott Wallace, the author of The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes, and a frequent contributor to National Geographic magazine. He writes about vanishing cultures and the environment, and we are talking about the Amazon. Could you please tell us about the natural riches of Yasuni National Park, where it is, and what some of the threats to its existence are?
The Yasuni is in eastern Ecuador. It is an extraordinary area because it has contained some of the most biodiverse land on Earth. There is just kind of off the charts in terms of the number of species, actually the diversity of species and the numbers of each species. There are 10 different species of primates. It's possible to walk in the Yasuni and see most of them in a single day in different families. They are I've never seen as many primates in the Amazon as I have in Yasuni. There is kind of off-the-charts biodiversity in terms of reptiles, amphibians, birds, trees, plant life. There are more species of trees in a small lot inside the Yasuni than in all of North America, as many different insect species in that same space as in all of North America. So there's an incredible abundance of species. This is an area where the Amazon, the Andes, and the equator converge. And that's why scientists believe there's such an incredible explosion of life there. You have near constant rainfall, light, and temperature throughout the year. And it seems to have given rise to this incredible species pump, if you will, of life. And then, of course, the biggest threat there is the oil that's under the ground. There's also timber, which represents a threat as well, the deforestation that comes from illegal and rampant logging. But certainly the biggest threat to the Yasuni in terms of its biological and cultural vibrancy is the oil industry, which is continuing to make inroads every day deeper and deeper into this forest. Even though part of it is actually in a national park, they are exploring for oil. There are oil activities underway inside the Yasuni National Park. Who are the players? The Ecuadorian state government has its own oil company, the state oil company of Petro Amazonas. The Chinese are in there. There's some activity from some of the Western oil companies, but a lot of it is Chinese and Ecuadorian. The Spanish company Repsol is there and a number of others.
And you write in your articles that as soon as those roads are built, some of the local tribes move there, and that also harms the local ecology in a strange way with the bushmeat situation.
Right. The first oil road, the major oil road, the first one built in Ecuador was done by Texaco, whose parent company Chevron is now embroiled in a multi-billion-dollar lawsuit with plaintiffs from indigenous and local communities in the Ecuadorian Amazon. And the road that they built is known as the Auca Road, which led to widespread environmental devastation and uncontrolled colonization. Once that road was cut into the forest, it opened up a huge floodgate of settlers who came down off the Andes and sought land in the Amazon. But since then, other attempts have been made to build oil roads that would not lead to that unchecked colonization. So Maxis, an oil company from the U.S., built a road in the 1990s that was supposed to be a controlled access road that now leads to an oil block inside the Yasuni National Park operated by the Spanish company Repsol. It's actually a consortium that Repsol leads. But anyway, that road is a controlled access road. You can't get in there without going through a checkpoint and having your belongings searched, go through an X-ray machine and so forth. But what the creators of that road did not foresee was that even having a road inside the forest, even if you can control access from the outside, it acted as a magnet for indigenous people living inside the area, and they moved to the road. You know, they were interested in the Western goods that they could find by proximity to the Westerners coming in, and they gravitated to the road, and then once they were there, they acquired firearms and started hunting and began to deplete the forests with a rather brisk bushmeat trade. They could trade their meat on the outside, get more shotgun shells, and pretty soon what you've had in Ecuador along that road is a similar kind of situation to what you have in the Congo with empty forests. The wildlife is disappearing from the margins of the road.
Scott Wallace, let's move on to logging of Peru's portion of the Amazon. You were there. I was distressed to read in your article in National Geographic magazine that most of the country's famous mahogany is almost gone. What happened to it and what is being cut in its place?
Yeah, so this is in the April issue of National Geographic about mahogany's last stand. So mahogany, which, as we know, the finest tropical timber, has been logged out of most of its traditional range in South America. In Brazil, as a matter of fact, in the a little more than 10 years ago, Brazil declared a moratorium on the mahogany trade there. It's actually illegal to export mahogany from Brazil. And once Brazil banned the mahogany trade, it kind of jumped across the border in Peru. So in recent years, Peru emerged as the leading supplier of mahogany timber to the world, to principally to U.S. and Western European markets. And what you've had in the last couple of years is, with the stocks in Peru now declining and a crackdown underway in Peru as well, that loggers are turning to other species that are not as well known and not as well protected. And so now you have a whole sort of list of different sorts of timber being cut in Peru in a rather uncontrolled way. There are few logging operations who are actually doing things right. There, I did visit the concession of one company that seems to be adhering to the law, but for the most part, you have unchecked logging. There are huge shiwawako is this magnificent tree. You can see today in the Amazon these things being carted out on flatbed trucks, trunks that are, you know, 4 feet in diameter, you know, hundreds of years old, that are just being taken away with absolutely no control.
What's hard for us to understand is, why can't the authorities seem to stop this illegal logging, even in national parks or lands protected for tribal peoples? Why can't they stop it?
Well, part of the problem is the vast distances that the Amazon embraces. I mean, you know, the Amazon has thousands of tributaries, and it's very difficult to patrol. Part of the problem is also a lack of resources. You know, a lot of the South American governments don't have great resources to work with, or they lack the political will to dedicate those resources to environmental protection. In most of the South American countries that have significant lands in the Amazon is seen as kind of a backwater place that, you know, doesn't command a great deal of attention in the metropolitan hubs. And so it's kind of an afterthought to dedicate resources to the protection of the environments in these places. And, you know, lastly, I think there is a good bit of racism involved here as well, that, you know, the principal inhabitants of lots of these areas in the Amazon are indigenous people, and unfortunately they are not viewed as equal citizens in many instances in these countries there.
Well, the other end of that stick is, there are people here in the West and in Asia who are buying illegal Amazonian wood. I know Greenpeace has tried to track down those markets and stop people from doing it, but as long as we're going to keep paying for it, I guess they're going to keep cutting it.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, so in fact, Greenpeace was one of the big prime movers behind the moratorium on mahogany logging in Brazil. They actually worked hand in glove with the Brazilian environmental police to bring awareness to that problem to, you know, the people who needed to take some action on it. But you're right. We continue to consume products from tropical rainforests without giving much of a thought of where those products are coming from, where the wood is coming from, and what kind of deals were made to actually get that wood into the showroom floors, into the Walmarts, into the, you know, Home Depots. I think there is a growing awareness, there has to be a greater one, that in many instances these trees were taken in less than above board dealings, and that we need to be certainly more conscientious about where our products come from.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with author and journalist Scott Wallace. His latest book is The Unconquered, and you can read his articles in National Geographic magazine. You can find his website at scottwallace.com. Well, Scott, I'm wondering, there were two great droughts in the Amazon rainforest of all places in the last couple of decades. What is your take? Is it possible global warming could convert big parts of the Amazon from forest to grassland, perhaps with the help of ranchers and other logging operations?
There's a growing consensus among scientists who are familiar with the Amazon that there's a very great danger that the Amazon is fast reaching a tipping point, if it hasn't already reached it, in which it will begin a irreversible decline toward a savanna-type scrubland. The droughts that you mentioned, when the first one hit in 2005, you know, scientists called it a once-in-a-century event. It was devastating. But then 5 years later, in 2010, there was another one. The rivers fell to all-time lows, stranding hundreds, thousands of communities in the backwoods of the Amazon, leaving untold millions of fish to wither and die on mudflats. Billions of trees withered and died. And, you know, you have a situation today where the Amazon is in danger of becoming a net producer of greenhouse gases through decomposition of forest land, through burning forests rather than a carbon sink. So it's a precarious situation. Yeah, we really need to pay attention.
Scott, gold is all the rage with worried investors all over the world, and some of it does come from the Amazon, but what is the true cost of that gold?
Yeah, gold is one of the big problems you have in the Amazon today. Alluvial gold, to extract it, is an incredibly polluting, destructive process, which involves the use of high-power hoses in some instances, or gold dredges that chew into riverbanks and spew out tailings for miles. The process to leach the gold from the ore uses either arsenic or mercury, highly polluting and contaminating chemicals, which find their way into the food chain. So gold mining today is a threat to indigenous lands. It's a threat to the Amazon. It's a major polluter of the Amazon, and is one of those things. Again, you see, it seems to be almost an impossible practice to bring under control with the lack of law enforcement on the ground in these countries and the destruction that is entailed when gold miners go into areas. And, you know, these wildcat gold miners can make, you know, a small fortune, even though they may subject themselves to, you know, poisoning and so forth. A dirt poor person goes into the Amazon and, you know, if he's lucky, he can make $500-$600 a week, which is a huge amount of money. So it's very difficult to stop this. And, you know, we know the price of gold continues to rise, and as it does, the, you know, incentive for people to head off into the jungle to find it does too.
Well, mercury poisoning is no joke. We call it Minamata disease after the place in Japan that first experienced it. Have some of the tribes had that problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's the one instance that comes to my mind among the Kayapo in central Brazil in the Xingu River Basin. There is a gold strike there, and I've been there and talking to a nurse who was working for the state health agency in one of the Kayapo villages, and she told me about just sickening birth defects in the community that no doubt was a result of the mercury poisoning from the mine.
And you've just blogged about a raid against native people in Venezuela that could be related to gold. Can you tell us about that?
You know, the Yanomami in southern Venezuela, Yanomami are one of the most remote tribes. They live on both the Brazilian and Venezuelan side of that border. And gold has been a huge problem for them. Their lands have routinely been invaded by gold prospectors. There have been successful efforts to expel the miners from the Brazilian side, which is really where they're coming from, is the Brazilian side, because there's a highway, a road that leads into Yanomami territory from the Brazilian side. The Venezuelan side is much more isolated, but the Brazilians actually also cross over into Venezuela by foot. And there have been many encounters, violent encounters, between the Yanomami and the gold miners in the past. And this one particular rumor of a massacre, no one has actually been able to verify whether it happened or not. The distances are vast, which makes reporting these kinds of stories extremely difficult. It's very difficult for personnel to get into these areas to investigate. So far, we don't know whether this actually happened or not.
Yeah, aside from the tremendous time it takes to get in there across many rivers, and as you say, carving your own canoes if you have to, you've got armed people. You've got people armed with curare, the poisoned darts, blowguns. You've got some angry people on all sides. Did you feel some fear when you made some of these trips?
Yeah, I mean, so there's always a certain element of danger when you're working in a frontier area, or in fact, in the case of my book, In the Unconquered, when we actually crossed over the frontier into the completely wild Amazon, where there are quote-unquote wild people still holding forth who do have curare-tipped darts and arrows. The Amazon is a place that is dangerous. Yeah, I mean, there are moments when one feels the hair stand on end, the hair on the back of your neck. I write about in my book this instance where we thought a couple of our companions had disappeared and had either been kidnapped or killed by the Arrow people, and the sense of impending doom that took hold of us as we surveyed the forest around us, this very closed forest where you can't see more than 30 feet in any direction, and, you know, the dread that these indigenous people whose land we had essentially intruded upon were preparing to attack us.
And we've been talking about wild people, those who can survive without civilization at all. Are there more such tribes in other parts of the world?
There are a few known uncontacted groups on the Andaman Islands, off the coast of, it's actually part of the protectorate of India, off the coast of Burma and Thailand. There may be, but we don't really know, there may be still such one or two such groups in New Guinea. But without a doubt, the vast majority of them are in the Amazon, in the western Amazon, and in the area that we traversed in the course of this expedition I was on that I read about in the book, The Unconquered. That area, the Javari Valley in western Brazil, has the highest density of uncontacted groups anywhere in the world. Within the Javari Valley, which is an area about half the size of the Floridian Peninsula, there are at least 18 uncontacted indigenous communities in that area. And so really the place where these groups continue to hold forth is in the western Amazon. And I say hold forth because by every appearance, these are groups that are deliberately hiding from us. They don't want contact with us. They know that we are dangerous. They know from past experience, either because of the disease and the die-offs they experienced, their people experienced in the past, or because they've been shot at by Westerners with rifles, they know that we are dangerous, and they have made a deliberate choice to withdraw and keep hidden from us. And so one of the things that I think is fantastic about Brazil's policy, although I have to say the current government in Brazil is not a friend of the indigenous people of the Amazon, but nonetheless, this policy of no contact and protecting these tribes is a extraordinary recognition of the self-determination and the self-will of these people to be left alone. And for that, I applaud the policy of Brazil and the other countries as well, Peru and Ecuador and Colombia, all are coming around to recognizing that these tribes actually represent not only a national treasure, but a treasure of all humanity that should be respected and protected.
Are there nonprofit groups trying to help protect the rights of these Aboriginal people?
There are. Survival International is one that comes to mind. The Amazon Conservation Team, which is based outside of Washington, D.C. in Virginia, is another one. Amazon Watch. There are several groups working to defend the rights of indigenous people and the uncontacted tribes in the Amazon, either by pressuring the governments to demarcate lands, to stop oil exploration in the lands where uncontacted groups are known to exist, or to stop loggers from logging in those lands, or to actually help indigenous tribes who inhabit the borderlands around these places where the uncontacted tribes hold forth, to actually organize them in vigilance committees to protect the boundaries of these protected areas, these national parks and protected areas.
Well, as we wrap up, I should point out for listeners that you, Scott Wallace, have followed dangerous and fascinating stories all over the world. There's a good biopic about you on your website, scottwallace.com, and on YouTube. And I just will ask you in closing, what will you work on next?
Well, I continue to work in the Amazon. It's an area that's just fascinating for me because there's so much going on there. But I am also very interested in the story that involves my grandfather, who was an explorer and adventurer back in the 1930s, who claimed in 1931 to have discovered a lost tribe in the Himalayas. And so I am looking closely into that story now as a possible long-term project to try to understand what runs in the bloodline here, that I have this grandfather who did that kind of work, you know, a century ago, and here I am doing something somewhat similar. So that's something I'm interested in.
Yes, I wonder if we're searching for something about ourselves when we're looking for people who are beyond the television.
I think so, for sure. And I think, you know, there's something inherently exciting just knowing that these groups still exist out there. You know, the fact of the matter is that these people continue to live the way we did for probably 99% of our history and prehistory. They know how to live without our industrial commodities. They are almost entirely self-sufficient from the outside world. We know that some pieces of steel filter back into the communities. We can tell that from the trees that they might cut down or something that we can see from the air. But by and large, these are communities that know how to exist without anything from our modern society, our moneyed industrial society. And I think that for all of us holds a certain fascination and should be an inspiration to everyone, I think, in the conservation movement, because this is the real sort of human face of environmental conservation in a very fundamental way.
You have been listening to Scott Wallace, author of The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. He's a frequent contributor to National Geographic magazine, writing about vanishing cultures and the environment. Find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.info and get the latest from scottwallace.com. Scott, thank you so much for sharing your adventures with us.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure being here today.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can take that Scott Wallace interview as the first installment in my series on human extinction. Next week, we'll investigate the growing chorus saying the human species will go extinct before the middle of this century. I'll tell you who's behind it, what the real science says. It's a tale with a twist. Tune in next week for sure.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
Meanwhile, I have to update you on stories you heard first on Radio EcoShock. In our program on the 1st of May 2013, you heard Nicole Rycroft of the green group Canopy explain why they pulled out of the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement. It was a key effort to preserve at least half of the necklace of slow-growing trees across the top of Canada, now being clear-cut and logged by dozens of forest companies. Rycroft told us after 3 years of direct negotiations with major logging companies, promises were not kept, deadlines were not met, and not a single hectare of boreal forest was legally protected. Canopy is going back to the 700 companies who promised to avoid old-growth timber from Canada's boreal forest. Now the largest company involved in the boreal, Resolute Forest Products, and they were formerly known as Abitibi Bowater, they have pulled out of the talks. Resolute says the environmentalists are asking too much. The company would have to close mills, and the impoverished northern Aboriginal communities would suffer if Resolute doesn't continue massive logging operations in the north of two Canadian provinces, Ontario and Quebec. Some Canadian newspapers reported the agreement had collapsed now that Greenpeace, Canopy, and Resolute Pulp and Paper were out. Other large timber companies have not announced they are leaving the talks, although they may if they feel they will be at a competitive disadvantage. Three large environment and conservation groups say they will continue to push for protection of the boreal forest through this agreement. One major funder, the Ivy Foundation, put at least $5 million into this effort. Here is a statement by Todd, Executive Director of Forest Ethics, followed by Tim Gray, Program Director of the Ivy Foundation. I recorded this from a media conference on May 21st.
Hi, folks. This is Todd Paglia. I'm the Executive Director of Forest Ethics, and I wanted to offer you some of our reflections on this unfortunate endpoint with Resolute. First of all, I want to emphasize that I think I can speak on behalf of all the NGOs that are part of the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement in saying that we feel that the CBFA has a model that works, that it can succeed, and that in some cases it is beginning to succeed, and that we are still committed to the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, even while at the same time we are at an end point with Resolute. So I want to make that part clear. We have seen over the years a lot of extremely hard work, literally tens of thousands of hours in the CBFA, working towards win-win solutions that are extremely difficult to arrive at. Getting environmentalists and logging companies to come to an agreement is not easy. And what we're seeing with companies that we're working with in the CBFA, like Tolko, Weyerhaeuser, Cornerbrook Pulp and Paper, Tembec, Alpac, Miller Western, is that there's a real sense of rolling up our sleeves, diving in and trying to do the hard work of coming to an agreement where every side gives. And that is exactly the opposite situation we have been in for the last 3 years with Resolute. And with Resolute, their stance has been pretty much all take and no give. And when we look at the CBFA going forward, we feel like Resolute is the bad apple, and that the rest of the bushel is in very good shape and will make progress that we're all going to be proud of. I think Janet has already summarized a bit of a sense of where we ended up with Resolute doing basically what in Quebec the law requires. In other words, the CBFA would then stand for we are not illegal. That's not exactly the vision that we had for the CBFA, and it's not acceptable that Resolute has adopted that position. In Ontario, as mentioned, they have expanded operations since the signing of the CBFA. And in the midst of our negotiations last week, in the closing hours of trying to come to a win-win, they announced during their annual general meeting an expansion and that they're going to be acquiring more companies. In other words, fragmenting these already fragile forests even more. All of these things are anathema to the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement and the goal that we all had in signing on to this incredibly ambitious endeavor. And for forest ethics, what it means in the marketplace is that Resolute will be increasingly a source of conflict paper, pulp, and lumber products. That as opposed to coming to agreement with NGOs to do the hard thing of coming to a compromise, they're pursuing their narrow economic interests. And that means more and more conflict for them moving forward. And so when we speak to the North American and European and beyond marketplaces, what we'll be saying is that if you're looking for a product that will put your brand at risk, look no further than Resolute. Now, I'll conclude there, and I think we're handing it off next to Tim Gray from the Ivy Foundation.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, this is Tim Graham, Program Director with the Ivy Foundation. The Ivy Foundation is a private charitable foundation based in Toronto. And we support solving complex environmental and economic problems through collaboration. For that reason, we've provided over $5 million in funding to the implementation of the CVFA over the last several years because we believed it was a framework for conserving forests in a way that would enhance economic prosperity. We've had a history of funding collaborative exercises between environmental organizations and industry, including in Ontario under the Ontario Forest Accord, and in Nova Scotia with the Colin Stewart Forest Forum. Both of these resulted in significant increases in the amount of protected lands with full collaboration and buy-in of major forest companies. Unfortunately, in the current situation, resident forest products have been unable or unwilling to agree to conservation measures that would meet minimum standards required to achieve a reasonable chance of survival for woodland caribou within their licenses in northwestern Ontario and Quebec. They've also failed to agree to recommendations that would complete a network of protected areas that would ensure other plants and animals in their harvest areas have adequate parts of their ranges protected as a guarantee of future survival. We're very disappointed that no progress has been made with Resolute, but of course we will continue to support the implementation of CBFA in other areas. In my view, the failure to achieve an outcome here is a result of poor leadership at the senior management levels. We had very constructive, collaborative discussions with folks on the ground within the company, but the leadership of this company did not want this agreement to work, and that we're very disappointed.
You just heard Tim Gray from the Ivy Foundation, preceded by Todd Paglia of Forest Ethics. Both groups still support the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement process, despite the loss of other major environment and company participants. I don't know if the process can continue, or if they can protect enough of the boreal to save the endangered woodland caribou. The real issue, from my perspective, is not just the value of this intact ecosphere of the North, as important as that is, but the big impact rampant logging will have on climate change. The boreal forest could turn from being a carbon sink, moderating what is left of our climate, to a carbon source. This huge northern forest could take hundreds of years to grow back, if it ever does. Meanwhile, we witness another positive feedback loop heating the globe and created by the human impulse to grab natural resources at any cost, at any risk. Environment groups like Greenpeace and Canopy will push Resolute Forest products to meet the needs of nature. You can help by disinvesting in this rogue company and making sure your pension plans and corporations are not supporting their paper products. On to another story brought to light by Radio EcoShock. Over the years, I've investigated the claims and activities of one Russ George. On September 7th and 14th, 2007, I did a two-part interview and critique of George's attempt to modify the climate by stimulating plankton blooms with iron. That effort failed. The multi-million-dollar stock promotion of his company, Planktos, went bankrupt. In the middle of October 2012, I did interviews and clips from a Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation press conference at the Vancouver Aquarium. Leaders from the Haida village of Old Masset attempted to explain to the world press how and why they secretly performed a geoengineering experiment, possibly the world's biggest, in the Pacific Ocean near their home on the island of Haida Gwaii. The village spent $2.5 million on Russ George's dream to create carbon credits for sale and allegedly replenish the failing salmon stock. No carbon credits were sold, and it appears the villagers will lose their money in this scheme. On April 10th, I announced the offices of the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation were raided by armed officers of the federal agency Environment Canada. All computers and files were taken away. Despite this, Russ George told the Times Columnist newspaper in British Columbia that he and the First Nations people would run a second experiment on the wild algae in the summer of 2013. He's gonna do it again, he said. On April 30th, I attended an online briefing by the American National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, on marine geoengineering and possible legal barriers against unilateral experimenters like Russ George. The audio quality is poor, but you can make out these two quick clips. First, Richard Mannix, a legal expert from NOAA's Office of the General Counsel, notes the Russ George Haida Village experiment may have damaged clam beds on the island of Haida Gwaii. Second, lawyer Richard Mannix points out there is no central legal authority to regulate or stop geoengineering experiments. Dumping iron into the sea should be controlled by the London Dumping Convention and the London Protocol, but there is nothing saying who might spray sulfates into the atmosphere or launch mirrors into space to reduce sunlight arriving on our jointly owned planet. Without such an agency, Mannix feels we are encouraging a wild west of geoengineering. Let's listen in.
Well, fortunately, ocean fertilization seems to have a home, but there isn't a home yet for other techniques. It's not going to be one home. If we're talking about putting mirrors in space, that's not something that the London Convention can take care of. That's another treaty. But we need some kind of coordinated approach to these things so that it doesn't become the Wild West. We need some kind of common set of principles. We need some forum for dialogue. We need to bring this together in some organized way. If the international community is going to continue to adopt ad hoc bans on specific activities, that will discourage legitimate research that we need to give us direction. It will also tend to make the research something private, something hidden, something not open to the public or available generally to science. And it will also perpetuate an atmosphere in which the rogue nation or entity are going to feel free to go off and do what they want. And times are wasting, but hopefully we can bring this into some organized control relatively soon.
I managed to get in a question at the end of that teleconference, saying Russ George promises to repeat his ocean dumping scheme this year, and what could stop him? Well, the attendees did not know that Russ was planning to do it again, but Mannix replied he was confident in the Canadian authorities that they were investigating thoroughly, and it was possible, he said, Russ George could end up in the slammer. His words, the slammer, of course, is slang for jail. We will see. The story continues. On May 23rd, the Haida villagers announced on Canadian Newswire they were severing all ties with Russ George. The HSRC said, quote, it has removed Mr. Russ George as a director of the company. In addition, the HSRC has terminated Mr. George's employment as an officer of the corporation. Old Masset Village Chief Councillor Ken Ray stated, the board and our community has decided to recalibrate this business so that it moves forward in a constructive fashion and effectively responds to legitimate concerns raised by various stakeholders around the world, end quote. It sounds like Russ George is out of a job, but not so fast. Russ George told the Vancouver Sun he can't be fired. Russ George said the board of the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation did not have the authority to remove him. We learned from Russ that he owns 48% of HSRC through his own company called Ocean Pastures Corp. He's just a genius at setting up various companies with all sorts of names, as we've found out. George promised to keep on going with this project. Now that's moxie. His data and equipment were seized by the Canadian government with likely legal action pending. The Haida villagers, a potent group to say the least, insist they have severed all ties with Russ George. Village Chief Ken Ray told the Times columnist, we have parted ways. I would read that more or less as a ban from the island, especially since the senior governing body of the Haida already denounced the experiment. Ken Ray says no plankton seeding experiment will be done this year. Well, that should end the story. But Russ George never really goes away. He's back on his blog touting his other persona, the amateur physics experimenter with a world-saving technology in cold fusion. His company, D2 Fusion, went bankrupt years ago. On his blog, George says he's worked on cold fusion since its discovery in 1989. His work was making a documentary film about it. With the failure of this plankton scheme, again, Russ George could next reappear as a businessman advocate for cold fusion. It's never over for Russ George with his big dreams and multi-million dollar losing schemes.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
Moving on, I have one more recording for you. On May 16th, Eric Hoffner of Orion Magazine hosted a web chat called City Mouse, City Flower, a discussion of urban nature. Guests were Beatrix Beisner, co-editor of the new urban ecology guidebook, Nature All Around Us, and Liam Hennigan of DePaul University Chicago Wilderness Science Team, along with Kevin Anderson, the proprietor of the blog Marginal Nature. I was intrigued with the struggles and ideas in the discussion between Liam Hennigan, working from an academic planning perspective, and Kevin Anderson, who by day is a water and sewage worker for the city of Austin in Texas. Anderson definitely gets his hands dirty and laments the trend of cutting down foreign species to create the imagined past landscape, and during one of the worst droughts in living memory in Texas. Let's tune in as Eric of Orion Magazine brings up adaptation to urban conditions. Kevin Anderson weighs in with a hot debate. Should humans try to engineer nature again, this time right in the cities where we live? From Orion Magazine.
Yeah, this is Kevin. So one of the things I pointed out, right, it often gets focused on plants, the non-native plants, so buckthorn up in Chicago. And
yep.
Here we have our list, the Chinese species must be eliminated, even though they've been here since the 1850s. And one of the things that often happens, though, with those non-native species is they aren't studied for wildlife benefits. There's a presumption that they are less useful than the natives that were here. And when you begin to study them for what's utilizing them, many of these we're finding have become host plants for insects or our nectar sources, or, mm-hmm. And the list goes on. We're at a time where that's being battled out, mm-hmm. right, in culture and in that cultural practice and then into management. Within the science of ecology, that idea of a native species within ecology proper is of limited usefulness because it's temporally bound. This is very much a cultural question of what do we value, what are the most important, with, again, the exceptions that there are problem species. With plants, we've always called them weeds, and there's always been weeds. I will mention a book, Richard Mabee, the great British nature writer, his latest book, the title is Weeds. Again, when we shift into a European setting or a British setting, there is a different history, a different arc to this conversation about cities and native species and non-natives.
Yeah. I'm largely sympathetic to what you're saying, Kevin, but I note that you say, and it's an important qualification, that there's a lot of species that we're never going to worry about. Other than on lawns, people are not going to be worried about daisies and dandelions. But, when our objective, agreed through consensus, hopefully, that there are certain areas that are being set aside for their conservation value, then very often our biggest obstacle is a dominant invasive species.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
Managers are not going to get overly exercised about some things that are just hanging out in the system doing very little damage. But it is worth underscoring that there are certain species that create these conflicts for us.
But notice the context you mentioned, right? In a park or a preserve, and these are special landscapes managed for very particular.
Well, absolutely, yeah. The earthworm thing as well, as you probably know, there's no native earthworms, terrestrial earthworms in this part of Illinois. So we're in the kind of curious position where, I don't think anyone will be objecting to earthworms in the garden. In fact, that's a kind of a good thing. We have then this curious problem of having non-native earthworms in areas set aside for conservation. And without a doubt, they're changing the dynamics of these systems in ways that have us completely scratching our head. It's very difficult to manage for these things.
Yeah, and right, post-glaciation, those native species changed everything too,
mm-hmm.
right? So from the longer perspective of ecology proper, these are changes that unfold over time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what we decide to do within a refuge or a preserve is a special case. The other 90% or 95% of the urban ecosystem is another case. What I see in Austin, we try to take the same set of values and apply it for the whole system and ultimately are disappointed because the system doesn't behave the way we want it to.
So here's a kind of maybe the elephant in the room question. Several people have brought it up in the text chat here. It's got to do with the biggest question of the day, climate change. How would you suggest cities might best prepare, Mike wants to know, prepare their urban ecosystems for a rapidly changing climate? How are we going to adapt to that, and how important is our urban ecology going to be?
Yeah, I mean, in Chicago Wilderness, climate change is a central topic for us. We've got a climate change task force, and the city itself, I think, you know, over a couple of administrations has been out front on that being an issue. The thing is, what we know right about the urban environment is that the structures that we created have changed the heat budget of islands in a way that's not necessarily kind of conducive to our best interests. So we have a lot of management options for managing the urban environment, changing kind of the albedo, the kind of reflectance of surfaces, very often using kind of the management of nature. So in Chicago, for instance, we're blessed with a really vigorous urban forest, and that's kind of a big part of the plan, not only in terms of sequestering carbon, but in just like, you know, providing shade relief and in changing kind of the dynamics, the kind of radiation dynamics of the city.
I work for a water utility for a city, and things are quite bleak. We don't have a good track record in rapid response to change. And right now we're in a prolonged, very serious drought here in central Texas, in Texas, and we're improvising. We went through a similar drought in the 1950s, so we had plenty of time to plan and nothing really substantial was done. And so the greater change of climate that will surely unfold, the general things that we know we can do, and some of that was what Liam was mentioning, are there for us to do. And to use that example, Liam, right, that urban forest movement for climate is a different set of parameters than urban forest for greenery. I see this here in Austin now. We're still in the greenery stuff. It's great. There's a lot of motivation for urban forest here. But again, it's built around the native versus non-native species. And mm-hmm. So they're cutting down all of these thriving non-native trees that are on the hit list during a catastrophic drought. And folks on the climate side, and I would be one of those, would say, don't cut down anything living during this drought. They're the ones we should study because the system's changing. That's one aspect to the broader ecosystem parameters that are impacted by climate change. For another thing that we've recognized with water in the Southwest, right, is our power plants on waterways depend on a water temperature that can cool them. And during this extreme heat, the 2011 summer, where we had 90 days over 100 degrees, the water temperature got near to a point where they could no longer use it to cool their plants. And so these recognitions, too, coming with management of the city in a brand new situation, it's very daunting. And yet, as Liam said, there's some very basic things that we can do and we need to be doing, as well as looking forward and thinking about what will the new system be, because it's coming. Get Bill Cronin's book, Uncommon Ground, Rethinking the Human Place in Nature. It's 1995, and that's pushed a lot of the ideas that we're talking about. And again, Bill's point was we need to embrace the full continuum of a natural landscape, and that natural landscapes are also cultural landscapes. And I want to end with a shout-out to Orion, because much of my work on marginal nature traces back to an Orion writers group that was at the SER conference here in Austin in 1998, I think. Folks need
right.
to keep their subscriptions up.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for the endorsement. And actually, Kevin sent me a long list, a bibliography of books to read if anyone wants to see the entire thing. Email events@orionmagazine.org, and I'll send that to you so you have all your reading lined up for the next year. These conversations are made possible by subscriptions to Orion and by your donations, so please go to orionmagazine.org/donate to support our efforts to bring people together for conversations like this.
Find the full 80-minute discussion, City Mouse, City Flower, A Discussion of Urban Nature, as an audio file at orionmagazine.org, or use the link from my show blog at ecoshock.info. Next week, we'll ask the question, are we humans doomed to an early extinction? I hope the answer is no. You'll hear the arguments as Radio EcoShock continues to cover the biggest pictures. I'm Alex Smith. You can support my work at the show website, ecoshock.org. Catch up on any programs you've missed as free MP3 downloads at that site. Please tell your friends about Radio EcoShock, and thank you for listening.